This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We have lots for you this hour, but we want to take you directly into the soul-searching and painful aftermath of the shooting yesterday at Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas. A shooter takes aim at people on base. The base is locked down. After a bloody standoff, the shooter kills himself.
There are reports that he self-reported a traumatic brain injury previously coming back from the Iraq
tour. Any sort of medications?
He was on medications, that's correct.
A moment and a possibly telling detail from one of yesterday's briefings at Fort Hood. Here's President Obama speaking about the sense of vulnerability at military installations around the U.S.
They serve with valor and they serve with distinction. And when they're at their home base, they need to feel safe.
The Fort Hood case involves active duty personnel interacting with the military medical system. There is a much bigger issue for veterans, though. The VA deals with millions of claims, and since 2001 has paid more than $200 million in wrongful death claims, admissions that the VA missed something in treating post-traumatic stress disorder. Those wrongful death numbers and admissions come from a new investigation of VA treatment of combat vets by the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aaron Glantz is the staff reporter at CIR who broke this story. We'll hear from Aaron in just a moment. But we begin with Tracy Eisworth from Ocala, Florida, who yesterday, just a few hours before the tragic Fort Hood shootings, told us of her struggle for years to get her Iraq vet husband, Scott, treatment for post-traumatic stress.
He had severe PTSD. I mean, this became evident from the very time he came home. Within days, we had him at our family doctor for these very symptoms. But he had, it wasn't just nightmares, they were night terrors. So where he would be acting out in his sleep, he would be very moody, agitated, irritated most of the time. He'd have flashbacks to where he would be like in a conversation and something would happen, like a car would backfire, just different things. And then he would be back there at the war and you'd have to kind of bring him back to where he was today, not back then. Smells bothered him. Crowds extremely bothered him. He was not the same person that had left. He came back very different.
And you experienced these flashbacks and this acting out in your own bedroom.
Yes, it had come to a point, honestly, where it was not safe to even sleep in the same bed with him, because some of these night terrors would be so violently acted out that I was actually in fear. I mean, he had hit me a few times, and not on purpose, but by accident, just by being in his sleep and acting these things out. And we had thought you just called the VA, tell them you need counseling, you need help, and it was a quick appointment. It was not that.
And what happened? What did the VA do with your symptoms and all of these details that you're telling me?
It was paperwork, and it was a process to get into the VA to get help, which we did not realize the process would take so long. So we had Scott start civilian counseling. That was the only way to get immediate help, which he needed immediately. And the VA, it was not there immediately. It was a process, and that process took time.
As Tracy Eisworth, who's describing a story and a process that was very, very difficult for her and her husband after he returned from Iraq. There's more to this story, but let's pause for a moment. Aaron Glantz, what was it that the VA was doing here by putting up this process instead of treating symptoms, which you would think a medical institution ought to be doing?
This is something that we hear so often talking with veterans coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, where the VA has some of the best doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists in the country at treating war trauma. But then the agency has this extremely unwieldy bureaucracy that makes it very difficult for anyone to see any of these clinicians. We always hear about long wait times for necessary care. And as what we found in our investigation, that since 9/11, the VA had paid out over $200 million to nearly 1,000 veterans who died under the VA's care, and many of them died waiting for necessary treatment that could have saved their lives.
Now, Aaron, some might look at that $200 million in wrongful death claims and the 1,000 individuals that are involved here and say, okay, the system is working, the VA has a huge amount of responsibility, these are some errors that were corrected. How do you view this?
It's true the VA sees more than 6 million veterans every year. Somebody could take a look at the 1,000 deaths that the VA paid out money in a wrongful death settlement and say, well, some degree of medical error is inevitable dealing with a system this big. The way I look at it is these are people who served their country. They went to war. They did what we told them to do. Then they got home with the expectation that the government, which sent them to war, had created a healthcare system which would take care of them and meet their needs. And it's important that we really assess how often we fail these veterans and whether or not the VA is doing enough to prevent these deaths from occurring.
Tracy Eisworth, when you look at that wrongful death number, $200 million, do you see medical error here, or do you see systematic, really a lack of sympathy for what your husband went through?
Yes, I didn't get sympathy from the VA until after Scott's suicide. I mean, initially, they failed to properly diagnose Scott's PTSD. When he finally got through this process and got in to see somebody, it was an error in their diagnosis. And then that continued with improper treatment, which they admitted their error in misdiagnosing him. They admitted his suicide was service-connected. And I got an apology and retroactive benefits that Scott would have received when he was alive. My issue is I'm not a statistic. I'm not, you know, inevitably there's going to be error. My husband's dead. And that's the bottom line. I don't like hearing, well, statistically there's going to be error. That hurts me in my heart because of what we have been through, what we continue to suffer through because he is dead.
When was the first moment that you saw the VA taking your husband's case seriously?
Well, Scott had lost his job, so we had lost his insurance. So that was how we were paying for a civilian counselor. And it wasn't until a buddy of his told him the only way to truly get in is just show up at the ER, just show up at the door and walk in. And then at the ER, at the VA, they have to see you. So that's what he did. It took him making that step before they even knew his name. So it wasn't until January of 2007 before he actually went to the VA and started the new process of getting referrals and getting doctor's appointments and all the follow-ups. But he came home November 23rd, 2005.
Aaron Glantz, is that the pattern of what your investigation shows, that the system encourages people to essentially get desperate to make their medical needs known?
We see all kinds of troubling deaths in the data. A veteran who hangs himself by his belt in a VA psychiatric ward in Seattle. A veteran who is admitted to the psych ward in Portland, Oregon, and ends up jumping off of the roof of the hospital to his death. We have 10 cases in Southern Illinois where a single doctor botched surgeries, and it's inexplicable that the VA would have hired him since he was already under investigation by the medical board in Massachusetts. So he just moved to Illinois and got a job with the federal government. We see all kinds of problems, but the thing that is so troubling is the level of denial in VA about these problems. Yes, they paid all these settlements, but they had to be dragged kicking and screaming into most of them. You know, Tracy, for example, is still fighting with the VA many years after her husband's suicide, because even though they said, we made a mistake, he had PTSD all along, you should have been getting these benefits, they have denied repeatedly the wrongful death claim that she's filed and are currently fighting it in federal court on a legal technicality.
Tracy, how long did you believe your husband was close or capable of taking his own life after he returned from Iraq?
I never seen it coming. And that was the point when I walked in to our house to find him. What really gets me is these denials for PTSD claim that he had repeatedly got was due to technicalities. I mean, it was, you didn't do this document, you didn't file it this way or whatever. So his PTSD claims, his first claim was May 2006. He killed himself May 2008. And most of that was due to technicalities. You didn't fill out the paperwork. You didn't do this right. And so whenever he received his last denial letter in May of 2008, he ripped it up. And at that moment, I did see a change in him. He gave up. He stopped going to the VA counseling. He stopped going to the VA doctors. He stopped taking the medicine. And he said, I'm done. And within a couple months, he was done. He had killed himself. I'd never seen it coming.
So, Tracy, you and Scott believed through this entire frustrating process that you were going to get through this.
Yes.
And you filled out every form, did everything they asked, and they let you down.
Yes.
That's crazy, Aaron.
The craziest part is that here we are in 2014, 6 years after Scott's death, and the VA is still fighting to avoid paying a wrongful death payment to Tracy to help her and the two children that she had with Scott survive without his income and veterans benefits. And when you think about that for a minute, and then you turn around and you look at the fact that the VA has paid out $209 million to almost 1,000 families, and you know that they really hate doing that, that they usually fight in the way that they're fighting with Tracy, it gives those numbers so much greater power and meaning. And it becomes very troubling that there isn't somebody in Washington saying, we have to stop this from happening again.
Is there anything the VA can do to end this tomorrow, Tracy?
I don't know. I mean, I've heard since Scott's death, the process has changed. It's now a phone call. I see all these 1-800 help numbers for veterans, and I truly hope that it is better, but it still doesn't replace our loss. And I don't mean to sound ungrateful for the changes that has occurred and the soldiers that are getting help, but it still doesn't replace our loss.
Tracy, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Tracy Eiswirth's husband fought with the Army National Guard in Iraq. He committed suicide after returning home, suffering from PTSD. Aaron Glantz is a staff reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The VA's response to this investigation came from spokeswoman Victoria Dillon. Quote, any adverse incident for a veteran within our care is one too many. She also noted that when a death occurs, the VA, quote, conducts a thorough review to understand what happened, prevent similar incidents in the future, and share lessons learned across the system. Early today, we asked military wife and mom and now widow Tracy Eiswirth, who you just heard from, her reaction to the news from Fort Hood. She told us, my heart goes out to the families because I have a sense of what they are going through. Unless you have been there and lived through something like this, when a soldier comes home suffering, it's a hell all of its own. To hear this news about Fort Hood, Tracy Eiswirth told us, it hurts.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.